gotta earn it. This week's Parsha Shmini doubles also as Parsha's Para. Right, is this Parsha's Para also? Para? I think it's Para also, I think. Also Parsha's Para. I want to try to tie them together if I can, and also discuss the aftermath of Purim. Psst. Expect full attention. Not like a Mershir. Not like a Mershir. I want to discuss a very troubling event that happened in Jewish history. I don't mean the Purim Suda on Sunday. Monday. It's our trial. Much more troubling, much more serious than that. I put all joking aside. And that is the death of Aaron's two sons. In a very, very strange event, in the greatest, one of the greatest climaxes that we had at that period of time as a people, we got the Mishkan, we were sanctifying the Mishkan, they stepped out of line, granted, the Torah describes, they stepped out of line, they brought an Esh Zara, something that was not appropriate to bring, and for that, the Gemara in Sanhedrin, in Daf 52, and Daf Nun Beis describes that they were consumed by a fire, they were basically, their lives were taken, like a korban. That's what happened. What exactly did they do wrong? Number one, well, I have a few questions I want to ask you. Number one question, it's not that one. Number one, when Moshe Rabbeinu tries to comfort Aaron, so he tells him something that's very very hard to believe. It sounds like he's just exaggerating, but he says it, so how does Moshe Rabbeinu exaggerate? It says, in Pasuk Perek Yud, Pasuk Gimel, Vayomer Moshe El Aaron, Hu Asher Diber Hashem Lemor Bikrovaya Kadesh. This is what Hashem referenced to me way back when. Bikrovaya Kadesh, among my closest ones, I will sanctify myself. Quotes Rashi over here, a very troubling medrash. Moshe says, Aaron, achi, yodea isi sheyizkadish habayis b'miyuadav shal makom. I knew that when the Mishkan was being dedicated, there would be among people who were closest to God, not close, but closest to God, who would be involved in a very unique fashion, that would be Makadish and Shemayim somehow. Vayisi Savur, I always thought, Obi Obacha, you and I were the top two. We were ranked one and two in closest to God. I thought it would be one of us that would end up being taken or whatever would happen to us, sanctify God in the process. And then he says it afterwards. Look at what he says it afterwards. Please follow me inside, or not inside, outside. He says, Achshav ro'e ani shehim gedolim mimeni u'mimcha. Now I see they're greater than you and I. They're even better. They're really one and two. We're really three and four. So number one, okay, it's nice to give someone words of comfort. It's very appropriate. But like, over-exaggeration is not appreciated. What, Aaron and Moshe were not as good as another one of you? Come on. That's crazy, number one. Number two, if you look in the text itself, what did they do wrong? What does the Torah say they did wrong? What does the Torah say? Say again? Didn't say the Torah didn't say that. We say that. What does the Torah say? They brought an Esh Zara, a foreign flame, a strange fire. That's what the Torah says. However, if you look over here, it brings down, it says the word that they, it says, Vatochal Osam, in Pasuk Beis, Perek Pasuk Beis, Vatetze Eish B'lifnei Hashem, Vatochal Osam. The word Osam was also written in Pasuk Aleph, but the Pasuk Aleph Osam was without a Vav, and the Pasuk, the word Osam in Pasuk Beis was with a Vav, Osam. Why is that Osam with a Vav in the Pasuk Beis? So the Baal Turim says the Vav in Gematria equals six. Equals six. Because there were six things they did wrong. And it lists each one of them. They were drunk. Who said they were drunk? They drank a little bit of wine. They didn't get married. They were waiting for Moshe and Aaron to die. You know, they couldn't. They were counting down the days when these old people were going to die so we can take over. They did a lot of things that were not appropriate. And they list six of them over there. So number one, why doesn't the Chumash mention that? Why are we were kind of piling it on these people? That's not what the Torah says. And number three, really, just to finish off this question, is if they did those six things wrong, how could we possibly fathom that they were better than Moshe and Aaron? Even without anything wrong, it's hard to imagine. But now add on, besides the Esh Zara, six more things that Chazal described in great detail. And look in the Baal Turim there for a list of what the six things are from different Gemaras that are quoted. And we claim right now that they're better than Moshe and Aaron, even with those things in mind? That sounds very strange and very difficult to swallow. So let's analyze them if we can. What was your actual crime of Nadav and Avihu? Please follow me inside or outside, I'm sorry, but give me your full attention. I demand full attention. We're going to quote a number of people today who give different approaches. I'm going to try to apply it to our lives. First, Rav Hirsch. Shulchan Aruch Hirsch brings down in his commentary on Chumash a very beautiful idea that was the crime of Nadab and Avihu. It's not maybe what you and I think it is. It's not the Eish Zara, you know they did that as well. That was not their major crime. According to Christopher Hirsch, the crime they had was, they had basically, there was a breakdown of authority. What does that mean? It means that normally you have clear definitions, who belongs where, you know, where each person fits in the society. But they basically set that at bounds. They felt to themselves that really, you know, why should it be us? Moshe and Aaron are great, but they felt they also were great, maybe even greater. They were counting on the days when we're taking over, because that's what's supposed to happen next. We're the next ones in line. Like imagine in a sports team, for example, you have a guy, a 34-year-old shortstop, and there's a guy who's, you know, who's right out of the AAA, picked second pick in the draft 2 years earlier. He's waiting his time. Everyone's counting. When's the guy going to end up leaving? They had recently all these people who were cut, who were older. You know, they wanted big contracts, and the team cut them. And everyone's talking about, oh my gosh, what a big loss. And they're like, give me a break. The next guy's ready. He's ready now. Let him go. Cut the old ones. That's what they're saying. Saying it's time for us now. The crime was not the HR they brought. That was maybe what happened in the end. Their crime was they possessed a tremendous amount of arrogance. And they felt it was their time right now. They didn't respect the fact that someone else was in place of them. And their job is to wait, do what's right until their time is going to come, which eventually will come. But when a person has an arrogance, and by the way, I think it's probably the greatest crime of our generation. The greatest crime. When I say our, I mean yours and mine. Mostly yours. But mine as well. That's a certain amount of arrogance, a certain amount of inability to appreciate the definition of where everyone belongs. There's a famous story, which I'm sure I've told in the past, I haven't told, I'll tell you right now. I may have heard some other people besides me before in the past. And this is why the arrogance comes in. There was a great Rav one time, we were sitting in a plane next to a person who was a high-ranking member of the clergy. And this Rav had his grandchildren on the plane who were running back and forth trying to help him out. You know, Zaidi, can we get you this? Saba, can I get you that? Can we get you drink? Can we get you something? They were helping him out, and the person next to the Rav couldn't understand. He also, in his world, is a very, you know, a very high-ranking officer in his world. And he doesn't understand, why don't my grandkids, says the Rav, treat me the way yours treat you? Throws it back to him, it's very simple. He says, your grandkids, you know, maybe it wasn't a clergyman, maybe it was a scientist of some sort. He says, your grandchildren, you know, believe in evolution. Which means the older that you are, the closer you are to monkey. And therefore, you're more monkey-like than they are. They look at you as like, you know, outdated, old-fashioned. They know much more than you do. He says that my children, they view me as a link back to the tradition that we have as a Jewish people. I'm two steps closer to Harsin than they are. And for that reason, the respect that they show me is because their goal is to tap into a world that they're not part of right now. The world that we live in today is not like the one the Rav described. It's much more like the other person is. Technology-wise, you know, someone who's 10 years older than you doesn't know how to use a computer like you do. The phone, you have so much more ability than they do, and that creates a natural thought that they're outdated. They're old-fashioned. They know what they're doing not only in computers, but in life. You're more creative, you're more with it, etc. It creates and leads to a tremendous level of arrogance. I even heard from one of the students in this room right now, sitting here right now, told me only a few days ago. He knows people whose children called their parents by their first name. Can you believe that? How can you possibly call your mother and father, whatever, fill in the blank? How can that be? Because there's zero level of boundaries. We no longer have respect for each other. There's a tremendous amount of arrogance in the world. And I feel that it's my time now, and everyone else who's older, they had their time. Those days are over. But not only Nadab and Avihu didn't respect Moshe and Aaron enough, but they didn't even respect each other enough. It says they each brought. It says Chazal, what does it mean they each brought? Neither one even knew the other one was going to bring the Eishzara. They brought it independently of the other ones. Now, it's one thing not to respect your elders because you think they're outdated, but to not to respect your peers, the same as you. But I don't even look at them. You know why? Because it means that I believe that I am the most important decision maker in the world. Just me. Sometimes you see someone who goes to a great Rav and asks him advice about business. Now, the guy who's going is a businessman. It's much more in the Sephardi world than the Ashkenazi world. But many Sephardi who are multi billionaires even. And they'll go to a rabbi who's sitting in Na'aria in his room by himself, who runs the yeshiva, who's into Kabbalah. And they'll ask him for business advice. Whatever this guy did to make his millions / billions, you know, whatever classes he went to, business school and the Ivy Leagues, the highest, This Rav did not know that. What are they going to a Rav for? Pshat. It's a very simple thing. They want a bracha, certainly true. But they ask for advice. Why are they asking for advice? Because they believe that there's a, you know, there's respect. This person right now has a close connection to God. He's close with God. Closer than I am. Perhaps he has insight he can share with me that I didn't learn in business school. I didn't learn in that. It's a different way of thinking about things in the world. But it all comes from the fact that I'm a humble person, and I believe that you can share with me something that you know. I believe you can share with me. Many of you probably in this room over here, if a Rebbe, someone you closely put your arm around you and said to give you some little words of chizuk, you'd probably be okay with it. But if your friend did it, excuse me, who do you think you are? Giving me muster? I know what you do, and you shouldn't be dealt with. Well, listen, the guy does something also, but maybe he has something to share with you. But we don't want to view it that way. You know why? Because we're very full of ourselves. Chas v'shalom, so much pointed out a flaw of ours. That would reveal we're so fixated on when their time will come to the reverse. Everything else broke down, rules broke down, and that's what led to their great crime. Happens to be that as Jews, we believe that religion brings you closer to God by following rules. When you follow rules, you get closer to God. That's what we believe as religious Jews. The more you follow the rule, the closer you get to God. You know why? Because when it comes to God, God's not my pawn. I'm not using him. I'm trying to live and be close with him. But for pagans, it's the opposite. The way it works in the pagans, with idols, why do they sacrifice their idols? To make their idol do what they want the idol to do. I need rain. I give a sacrifice to my idol, and now I get rain. Why? Because my idol will now give me rain. What second? Now you're the king? Yeah, because by pagans, the way it works is that I do things for you, so you do things back for me. And frankly, it's not only pagan, that's the world we live in today. How many of us over here will do a favor of someone else, hoping in return we get a favor back in return? It's not for the favor. It's for me I do it for. That's a very pagan way of living in the world. As Jews, we don't believe in that at all. We do mitzvahs, we do things because that's what brings us closer to God. Not because God now does what I want him to do. God chooses whatever he wants to do, whatever's best for him. He can choose whatever he wants to do. I do things for God because that's what brings me closer to God. And that's it. And will he give me the answer I want now? Maybe. Hopefully. And if not, I'll do it again the next day. I've heard people say before they've davened for things that haven't happened in the end. You know what they do after that happens? Stop davening. Because it hasn't happened. Is God your pawn? Is he bound by your wishes? If you were a pagan, then he would be. Then you sacrifice him so you get in return. But if God is something you're trying to relate to connect to, it doesn't matter how God responds to your actions. You have one simple thing. You follow the rules that God laid out. And that's what God laid out for us. There are certain times we bring certain korbanos. But Nadav and Avihu did not follow the authority laid out for them. They wanted themselves to do what they felt was best, what they felt was most right. And therefore, they brought what they felt was right, the korban, and in the end, it ended up being their demise. I was reading the last few days, I read again, I'm a loser, Kabel, I read ESPN a lot, and I read now, I'm at a new state of loserness, is I read now the comment section on these articles, which is the most ridiculous thing, it's the biggest waste of time, but you get caught, it's like the most ridiculous comments you can possibly imagine, and that everyone is ripping on the other person before him. But in the last 2 days, I've read two articles with comments that I've never seen beforehand, just 2 days. Again, I've read comments the last few weeks, I've never seen it until the last 2 days, that are full of discussions of God. Because there were two stories that happened to be the person who wrote the first comment made a comment about God or about something that had to do with God. One was a boy, a high school kid, who was shot in the leg about, I don't know if you guys follow the story, about 2 weeks ago. And, you know, he was lucky to survive. He was in Chicago and some party and some shooting and he hit in the leg. And he played, he's a good guy, he's like 6'7", I guess he's pretty good probably. He won the game for his team with a 3-point shot at the buzzer just now, and won to get to the state tournament. And the kid himself said basically like, or the coach said, you know, this guy took his shot, but God had a different shot in mind. Some play on words with a shot, very nice. Okay. At the end of the day, though, everyone comments, God, you know, where was God when he got shot in the first place? Where was God? You know, everyone has their own, and there's a big debate now back and forth. God is God that. This morning, I read an article. There was a cornerback for Indiana University, that was in Florida with a few friends. Some say he was drinking. He claims he wasn't. And they went swimming and they got caught in an undertow and one of them, he almost died and they saved his life. And just now, he finally came out of his coma. Only a few days later, it wasn't a big deal. It wasn't that long afterwards. But the person wrote down, oh, you know, science comes through again and saves the kid. And then they started to get a debate. Well, science, is it God? Is it science? Everyone's sitting there ripping on either God or ripping on each other. Can you imagine a world, you know, assuming God created it, where some people have the gall to rip on God? To say without shame that there is no God in the world? Not like maybe, definitively, there is no God. You know how I know that? Because why would this happen in the first place? How do you explain this thing over here? How do you explain, etc.? Excuse me. Where are your boundaries? Are you at all realizing that you are a small, tiniest little speck in the world? You think you can give an opinion on God? Out of bounds. It's out of bounds. That's Pshat over here, I think, with Madame Avila's crime. What Andrew's really said the other day, when he came in this year the other day, I think is a certain humbling. Sometimes we've got to be humbled. Two things happened just now in the last, also, few days that should humble us somewhat. One of them was that plane, the Malaysian Air, that you'd imagine it's hard to miss something that big when you have tracking systems for it. But once in a while, for whatever reason it is, and I don't think God planned us to learn from this lesson. I'm not accusing God of that, or suggesting God did that. But just pointing out, we live in a world where you can Google anything you want, you can Google Earth, you can see anything in the world, and they can't figure out where some huge plane ended up. Maybe it went in the sea, maybe it didn't go in the sea. Maybe it was an object, they have no clue at all. Everyone's got an opinion. We have no idea. Okay, you know what? We don't always know things in the world. And just now in the world, I saw the clip on Yahoo the other day. There was the Big Bang Theory, I don't know if you guys are following this story either, was just, I don't know if it's the word proven, but they found evidence that for 30 years a certain man who's been suggesting it's true, and he had opposition, just found some sort of scientific evidence that supports his theory, and they came to his house and celebrated him, and he had a glass of wine and champagne with him. He's much older right now than he was when he first figured it out. And his wife and him, like they were all that his 30-year theory finally is now seemingly coming to be true. We live in a world when there's so much we don't understand or don't know. There's so much. And yet we have such strong opinions on things. And they're the most ridiculous opinions. You have a clue how God or why God? There's some, you probably have heard things before, people arguing about which team would this or Judah Cohen, could he score for LeBron? You've probably heard ridiculous things. And you probably, and whatever side you want to take. But it doesn't get more ridiculous than someone suggesting, you know, something about God or about God's creation of the world. It does not get more ridiculous than that. You think that the scientific evidence has a monopoly on how God does things? That's what you think? You don't have a speck of an idea how it works in the world. And just to humble you, you find that airplane. You figure out how people who had made this thing in a way that you're able to track it down, you figure out what that thing is. You can't find the airplane, but you think you understand how God works in the world? Give me a break. The arrogance that is running wild in the world we live in today is so serious and so strong. And it's the cause of a great tragedy like we have in our parsha this week. Different Pshat I want to share with you. Rav Schwab in the Torah brings down a Perek Tes, Pasuk Vav. It's not in the spot where the actual crime happens. He says that the Yetzer Hara that none of you had, that a great Yetzer Hara, is that they wanted to get so close to God, they wanted to shoot up to God and be like on that level when it wasn't yet their time. They had the Yetzer Hara, they wanted to skip steps to be able to be close with God. And it's not for them. You're not ready to be skipping steps. You need to take certain levels and procedures in order to get that close to God that they wanted to get to. And I think I saw a person myself on Purim. Purim is a time, and I'm sure you can all appreciate what I'm saying in some form or another, is when your Yiras Hashem kind of goes out the window. Not intentionally. When you drink, you lose your inhibitions. What does that mean, your inhibitions? It means normally when you be more cautious doing certain things, you kind of are less cautious with it. Why? Because you don't think as clearly. You lose some of your Yira, which means it's the day that should be Kulo Avas Hashem. You may hear people saying the words like, I love God, I love God. You see probably videotapes of it, actually. We probably have videotapes people have of actually that happening. But really, you have someone who says, I'm so afraid of God. Doesn't happen often in these moments. Why? Because when you drink, what you do is you release certain inhibitions, certain concerns, certain Yira type of things, and you're left with Kulo Ava. The problem is, not all of us have Kulo Ava to our HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And that was evident and obvious when you drink. You drink and you act inappropriately. Things that you shouldn't be doing. That shows that you do not have Avas Hashem. You don't. Now, you may want to have Avas Hashem. You may think you have Avas Hashem. But all you got to do is you got to release the yira that's on our, in our faces a little more. Give the guy a little leeway. And the true level of Avodah Hashem comes out. People who do things wrong, who say bad words, who do inappropriate things, that shows that you are not an Ohev of Hashem. You're not. You skip steps. Don't be drinking right now. Take the Ramah. Drink a little bit, take a nap. Be Yotzei. Don't let the beast loose when the Yiras Hashem that sometimes you might have is no longer around anymore. It's called skipping steps. Rav Schwab said, not with drinking, even though people did claim that they drink, not under you, that when a person skips steps, he's not ready for something that's about to happen, it's a sign of disaster. The Jewish people are wired this way. We're wired this way. We want nothing more than to get close to God. In the greatest level, we want to skip steps. Something I said in the past, I'm not sure I said this year, but I said in the past elsewhere, is what, in general, when it came to Matan Torah, if you guys recall, the Medrash says that every single nation of the world was offered the Torah. And each one of them said what? What's in it? And each one was told something that was a scary thought for them. Each one turned it down, except for the Klal Yisrael. It's not fair. We should also have been told a scary thought and see if we still want to take it. So it should be said, Nasa Vanishma, maybe that's why we gave a scary thought. We didn't say what's in it. But I heard a different shot. I heard a shot that says, we were also given our greatest fear. Our greatest concern was told us also. It was said to us, you can't go up the mountain. Not go up the mountain. You have to stay distant from God. Back to what we said before, a little distance. You can't be as close to God as you want to be. You still want to take the Torah or not? Because it means that you're going to have a time when you and God are not one happy family, that He's up above you. Are you okay with that? And as a Jew, it's hard for us to accept the fact that we can't get that close. Especially today, modern day Jew. We are that close to so many people. As we described, there's a breakdown of some layers. It's hard for us to believe, I don't understand God sometimes. I can't be as close as I want to be. That's why this is the Yira. Why can't this be Kulo Ava? It's hard for us to understand that. But that's the world that we live in. None of you did not get that point. The mitzvahs of HaKadosh Baruch Hu are exactly the balance that we need to get the closest to God that we can get to. When you decide that this mitzvah doesn't work for me, that means that you're taking a step and saying, I want to do something differently than God suggests. And that creates a tremendous challenge and a great risk. That either you go on the mountain too close to where you're supposed to go, you lose your boundary, lose your borders, which is terrible. Or it means that you took a step in the wrong direction, even distance yourself more from God because it felt better to you to do that. L'mashal, Rosh Chodesh is a mashal. Imagine a woman who loves her baby. And she gives the biggest hug. Love my baby. And she continues hugging him. And she squeezes and she loves him. It's great. Until after about a minute, she just killed her baby. Because she suffocated him to death. Sometimes you can't hug as much as you want to hug. There'll be a distance between you and God. Something you don't understand, you can't chop. It's part of life. You have two choices. You realize that God runs the world in a way that's best, and you embrace it. Or you say, I'm not okay with that in the end. And you pull another one of you, and you step out of bounds. And that's what they did wrong. Parsha's Para, this week's Parsha, is the balance of that. It's a mitzvah that makes no sense whatsoever. The person who I sprinkle the ashes on was Tameh, is now Tahor. The one who sprinkles the ashes and helps him out was Tahor, is now Tameh. A calf, it's the only... What? It doesn't make any sense to anybody. It's called the chok of chok. It's a chok. It's the paradigm of chok. Of non-comprehensible mitzvahs. It is exactly the thing that you and I need to remind ourselves of. When you read a parsha like the other view that says at some point in time we don't understand how God works. I heard the other day, I think I'm not sure I said this over at Purim when you were at my house, those of you who came. I want to say it, I forget if I did say it or not. But we say every day, Ein Kelokeinu, right? We say every day in Israel, we say at least. Did I say anything like this over at anyone? Told to you only. Okay, so I said to you last night, two nights ago on the phone. Ein Kelokeinu, we say after Ein Kelokeinu comes what? Not Ein Kelokeinu, what comes next? Ein Kelokeinu? Me! That's also I said it. Mikel Okeinu. Normally, if you're asking the question, you say Mikel Okeinu, Enkel Okeinu. Who's like God? Nobody. And yet we say Enkel Okeinu is like God. Mikel Okeinu, who's like God? What? I just said no one's like God. What do you mean who's like God? So I heard from the person, his name is Yuri Berzon. Again, I think I'm going to quote him also. I might have dinner, but I'll quote him now. He quoted someone else. I don't know who he quoted, but he quoted, I heard a week ago, that whenever you want to talk about God, you must begin with the following point. In Kelokeinu, you have no idea what God is. We have no clue what God is like. He's completely non-understandable. You have no idea. That's how we start. And once you have that backdrop, then you can say, Mikelokeinu. I can talk more about God, but I need to first realize that I have no idea what God is like. I have no clue who He is. Then I can talk more about Him after I have that in mind. But a person who cannot comprehend, there are rules he doesn't understand. For a person who doesn't appreciate the fact that there's a God, and he's far from that. And whatever rules God put in place, or the rules that you're obligated to keep for reasons that we don't understand, maybe, like Parah, then there's one to talk about. I want to finish off with just one last point, and we'll do a chetzi because I'm over time. Rav Shimshon Pinkus says in his Sefer Tiferet Shimshon on Chumash, he says that you have no idea the loss. We have no idea the loss that we had when we lost Adam and Eve. You have no idea. You're talking about the Kohen Gadol, his two oldest children, the ones that were closest to being the next ones in line, and they left the world at a young age before they were supposed to leave the world. You don't understand the loss that that was for Klal Yisrael. He says, you know what Bittul Torah means? It doesn't mean wasting time. Not only that. It means that you just took Torah that existed and you burned it. You have in the world X amount that you can do. And you took it and you chucked it out the window. You spent 5 minutes bottling, checking your phone outside when you don't need to be, schmoozing instead of learning, waiting for your Rebbe to come by and saying, I'm just not going to learn until he gets here. Or any other ridiculous thing that you do most mornings. Bittul Torah means not you waste your time, but you took God's Torah that He had in place for you and you burned it up. You destroyed it. It will never come back, ever. Because you didn't take advantage of your time supposed to have had. You didn't take advantage of it. And Barack Obama is getting a tough rap a little bit, because he put out his bracket. I'm reading also the commentaries on that as well. Everyone says, who cares? It's a big deal. 10 minutes, who cares? So it happens to be, as you know, they're right. What other people do? They go play golf. But who cares? Put a bracket up. The reason people care about it is because the world right now is a lot's going on. And if you want to do a bracket privately and call, you know, whatever, some other, you know, code name, fine, do that. But don't make a ceremony of your like, that's called a waste of time for the President of the United States to do. It's a waste of time. He deserves leisure? Of course he deserves leisure. But don't publicize your leisure that you do. Do it at your own time. Everyone needs breaks. But to make that, like, worthy of a conference? People are dying. There are things in the world that are you know, falling on their faces. There's terrible things going on. And you call a conference to announce your bracket? Like, that's just wrong. Make a bracket. I want you to make a bracket. You should. Call it something else. Call a different name. Go to some pseudonym. But that this should be a cause of attention? It's a waste of time. When someone dies in the world, we're maspid them. You know what we give a hesped about? We say, oh, imagine someone wrote a sefer called Tiferet Shimshon Pinkus, who passed away before his time in a car accident. Oh, we lost the Tiferet Shimshon. We lost the Shor Mitzvila. We lost the Shabbos and Malchus. We lost the Nefer Shimshon. So we lament. You know what God does? He celebrates. Oh, I got the Tiferet Shimshon. Not because he's here, because the Torah that he should have had, he got in the end. But you know what God does lament? But I lost the, making this word up, the Minchas Shimshon. Never happened in the end. I lost it. What you lament, God celebrates. Because you lament greatness that was lost in the world, God celebrates that greatness. But you and I have no idea. You can't even comprehend how much we lost. You don't understand how big a loss it is because you don't understand what it means to take advantage of your time. Last story takes 1 minute. It's a very short story and I'll stop. I read this morning Leilin Shabbat by Rav Zilberstein. He told her a story. There was a man who came in, a very, very old man. He said to me, he said, Rabbi, I beg you to learn with me. He said, sure, I'll learn with you. What do you want to learn? He said, Mishnayos. And his mom was panicking his face. I need to learn Mishnayos. I need to learn Mishnayos. Please, I'm learning Mishnayos. Fine. The guy learned Mishnayos. After a little while, he says to the person, he says, well, as a Holocaust survivor, what's Mishnayos? Why are you so fixated on learning Mishnayos? He said, because I'm a Holocaust survivor, my whole family's dead. And when I die, no one's learned Mishnayos for me. So I want to learn Mishnayos for myself before I die. For my neshama to have an aliyah that I learn right now for my own sake. So when I die, I learn Mishnayos for myself. Could you imagine a person who thinks while he's alive, you know, he wants to prepare for his death? That he wants to make sure that he lives his life in the best way possible? I heard Andrew really told me this a number of years ago, maybe it was 2-3 years ago. The Gemara Brachos brings down, if someone has bad Yetzer Hara, you tell them, you remind them of Yom HaMisa, the day they're going to die. Why do you say that they're going to die? Why the day they're going to die? Because you should live your life like a day you're going to die. You think Barack Obama would put out a press conference about his bracket if he was going to die that day? I can't imagine that he would. You can't imagine. Because it doesn't matter. It's called bittul. It's a waste. It's burning your life. It's burning away your hours. It's a waste of time. Now, God forbid, am I suggesting that any of you in this room over here should not waste your time. God forbid. I think you all have to waste your time. It's part of life. But I will suggest to you that you also take advantage of your time. It shouldn't even be close in hours of how much time you did and how much time you didn't. It shouldn't be close. And for those of you who don't understand this point, it's because you don't understand the gift that God gave you. It's all about you, you, and you. You live in a time of arrogance. Your life, you live 120 years, you think that learning for a year of your life, you know, you imagine you learn for the entire year, you don't. And then you think, I got to get to the next stage of my life, I got to go next, when I get, for what? What are you running to? What's the next stage for you? Get good classes? You're preparing for life right now. You're preparing that guy, Lermish Niles, for his life. Because he's going to die soon. He wants to have preparation for that day. How much are you preparing for your life? Your real life. It's not your job. It's not your real life. That's what you have to make money. It's your neshama. It's who you are. It's all that you are. How much prep time goes into that for you on a daily basis? Not even close the amount of time it goes to everything else in your life. Not even close. Those of you made the greatest error, they lost their lives for it. You have the gift of life. You make sure, this is Parsha's Parah, that you learn that we are well beyond, we don't even comprehend what God is in our lives, but our job is to do one thing, and to try our hardest to get as close as we can as now and without stepping over bounds.